Support for WPR comes from the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, an independent organization dedicated to creating experiences that educate, reflect, and inspire. More is at mmoca.org.
Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
Do you struggle to get everything done in a week? Are you checking your work email on nights and weekends? Do you think working 24/7 is the key to success? Well, our guest this hour will offer a different solution. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk about essentialism this hour, paring down our lives to the bare essentials, and how we can decide what our priorities are. How do we pursue less and not more? And why would we want to? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show if you have a question or a story to share. Let me welcome our guest, Greg McEwen, business writer, consultant, researcher. He is the author of Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. He is also the CEO of THIS Incorporated. Good morning.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. So you're telling me I can't do it all?
Well, I think that you're absolutely right about that. We all sort of know it, but somehow, for some reason, we're in a sort of bogus badge of honor era where we ask each other how we're doing, and the first thing out of people's mouths is, I'm so busy, I'm just drowning. But it all sounds a bit like a backdoor brag to me, and I think that we've been, for too long, oversold on this idea that doing more and having it all is the way to success, instead of being taught that actually, if we can just focus on the right few things at the right time for the right reasons, that this is the way that will actually increase our overall contribution and happiness.
So is there anything wrong with me, checking work email at night or on weekends?
Yeah, my whole position on this is it's not really, essentialism's not about, certainly not about me saying to somebody, this is what you should do and this is what you should not do. The whole idea is that if we've got to the point where we think we just can't say no, that we just have to do it all, that we have to try and keep up with everybody's expectations, that this is the stuff that leads us to resent people in situations in the first, in the now, but also it's the stuff that life regrets can be made of if you've written large over time. So I think the message is really one about empowerment, which is, if you don't prioritize your life, someone else will. And so it's not neutral.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that a little bit more. What is the problem with people having too much to do or too much going on in their lives?
Well, I mean, I think that basically we've been sold a bill of goods. We have been hammered home a certain message. You should do it, or if you can fit in, you should fit it in. As if there's no trade-off to that logic. The logic, I give a name to this, is non-essentialism. And we are absolutely, I mean, I think to be alive today in the developed world is to be affected or even infected with this idea. And the problem is that there is always a trade-off to every choice, and there's a trade-off to non-essentialism, and it's basically this, it's arithmetic. If you can either do many, many things sort of averagely well, or you can do a few things superbly well, and I think that, sort of a quantity versus quality analysis, I think that when people really think about it, they maybe often choose to do fewer things done better, fewer relationships more deeply invested in, the ones that really matter, versus 1,000, 2,000 friends on Facebook, if they really thought about it. But often today, the default position is just more and more and more.
Yeah. Are you an essentialist?
You know, I really try. I describe myself as an aspiring essentialist. And what that means is that I'm in constant experimentation with essentialism, which is basically what I think other people, you know, should do as well, which is just try it out. We're like novices with no. We just think we have to, and so we keep getting in this sort of busyness cycle in a way. We're so busy, there's no space to really think about things. We don't feel empowered to be able to push back, so then we just stay busy, and so the cycle continues. And so I'm in constant experimentation with this. It's almost like, you know, we talk about in design thinking having pilots try a new thing, see how it goes. In this case, I'm suggesting a reverse pilot. I'll try not to do something, see how that goes. Instead of the fear of missing out, it's the joy of missing out that can sometimes be discovered.
Yeah, well, we'll talk a little bit more about how to say no. But I still want to, how do you define essentialism?
Well, essentialism is the disciplined pursuit of what is essential and the disciplined pursuit of eliminating what is not essential, so that eventually we can make it almost effortless to live a life based around our essentials, to live a life that really matters. But better than sort of that almost academic definition of the subject is just to think about Kay Krill, who's the current CEO of Ann Inc., which is the Ann Taylor brand and the Loft brand. When she was early on in her career, she was saying yes to every kind of work assignment and even after work parties and even on the weekend social invites. And she just was saying yes to everything. And a mentor came to her and said, "You have got to learn to jettison the things and the people that have less meaning for you," and the reason was important, "so that you can invest in the people and relationships and activities that really do have meaning for you." And what's great about that story is that over time, now looking back decades from that, she says, "I've become very good at this. I can do it now. I do have no hesitation. If something's very important to me, to my family, so on, I can just say no to the other things." And everyone around her understands that. So it's a learnable skill to be able to actually apply this way of thinking, essentialism, to our lives. But it takes practice and experimentation.
Yeah. I sometimes feel guilty when I say no. How come you say missing out can also be a joy?
Well, actually, I want to put that back to you for a second. So tell me the last time that you said no and you felt guilty.
I said no to an invitation for a speaking engagement. And I felt, I feel obligated that I should take on these speaking engagements when asked, because I do so few of them. My schedule allows me to do so few of them in terms of I go to bed really early at night. And it was a noon hour affair, and I just didn't feel like it.
And so you said no.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And was it all a negative experience for you?
No, I have to admit, there was a deep relief, and I'm so happy I don't have to prepare for that and go through, you know. So yes, I was relieved, but then it was hard to make that phone call to say, "Well, no, I'm sorry, I can't do that."
Right. I'm so pleased that you shared that experience. It makes it all so much more real, this conversation. Mm-hmm. I mean, for a start, that's the whole point, is that there is a trade-off. I'm not suggesting that there's no downside to pushing back and saying no. Of course there is. And, of course, I'm not even suggesting that we say bombastically no to anyone or anything. I mean, it's not the word no. It's about navigating what's essential and what's not. But in your story, there is a downside. The downside is it's emotionally awkward. And often, if we haven't even practiced how to say no, it's even more awkward and more emotionally challenging and more filled with a warning that we will feel guilty. But also in your story is exactly the point that I'm making, which is that we've been oversold on this idea of you have to say yes and undersold on the value of not doing it. In the very moment of you saying no, the liberation that you feel from that, the sense of, freedom, even though it's just a small illustration, perhaps, in this case, is that I don't have to do it. I've got space to think again. I don't have to cram one more thing into perhaps an already overstuffed life. It's the same with our closets at home. I mean, I'm not talking about how to eliminate stuff out of our lives. Lots of books about that. But still, using it as a metaphor, when we've gone through our closet, we've taken out all these things that we really don't wear anymore and we don't love, and we put it in a box and we're going to take it to Goodwill, there is a sensation there of, I think it's not an exaggeration, of joy, of liberation, of space. And even though that's just a small example, repeat that again and again in the things that we get committed to in our lives. I think there really is a freedom, and yes, as I said before, an actual joy of missing out, where we can think and ponder about the things that we really do want to invest in.
Because my bosses were probably listening to that, that confession. Let me say that I also had done a number of these, and I had a number of different work-related engagements, and I truly was just tired. And I did say, you know, I don't have to say yes to all of these when I made that phone call. And I do admit it was it was liberating, and it was a deep relief. But how do we know if we need this advice in the first place, that we should pursue less?
I mean, there's a few litmus tests here. I mean, first, does somebody feel that they are stretched too thin at work or at home? Does someone feel that they are often busy but not feeling really productive? I mean, even just those two litmus tests, if someone finds themselves saying, well, yes, that is definitely true for me, then I think there is, the good news is that there's a way out, and this is the way of the essentialist. I think that there's many, many people, I mean, almost universally, when I talk to people all over the world now, that people feel some of this strain and some of this stress. I mean, I think it's the result of what I call a sort of busyness bubble. So we've had tulip bubbles, we've had real estate bubbles, we've had Silicon Valley bubbles. So we also are familiar with the idea as it pertains to things. It's things that become overvalued. We become irrationally exuberant. The asset is not really worth what people say it's worth, but everyone seems to be thinking it's worth a certain thing. And so it goes up and escalates. Well, that's true for all of these other bubbles. But I think that we're now literally in a bubble of more, or a busyness bubble, where the very busyness or desire for constantly more is itself overvalued. And so this is what produces this sort of social dynamic that we're experiencing now, where we are celebrating something we know deep down shouldn't be something we should be celebrating. Somebody just came to me just the other day and was celebrating with me. Like, how are you doing? Oh, I haven't slept for more than 4 hours a night for the last 2 weeks, they said. But it was the exuberance with which they said it that grabbed my attention. They weren't embarrassed about it. They were thrilled to let me know about that. And as we talked about it, it was fascinating because she was absolutely exhausted. She was stressed out. And as we went through the science of sleep, it became so obvious that this was a counterproductive measure. She thought it was leading to success, but there's no doubt that it was also undermining future success as well.
So are you in a busyness bubble? Do you have any questions about how you might pursue less? We are talking with Greg McEwen. He is a business writer, consultant, and researcher. He is the author of Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. He says we should prioritize our lives and pare it down to the essentials and work on those and not try to do everything. You'll be better off if you are an essentialist. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page if you have a story or a question to share. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. So are you overburdened? Are you looking for a way to simplify your life? We are talking about how to pare life down to the essentials and how to decide what those most important things are with the author of Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. Greg McEwen. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, you just told a story about a woman who was really excited and proud to share that she only got 4 hours of sleep a night because she's so busy. Greg, you say in your The Essentialist Manifesto, How to Do Less But Better, you say the Essentialist makes sleep a priority. Why is this?
Well, I mean, just come back to the science for a moment. So you'll remember in Anders Ericsson's study of what distinguishes good performers from superb performers. This is the same research that was made, sort of popularized by Malcolm Gladwell, where he talked about the 10,000-hour rule. So this was, you know, on the face of it, the people that performed better were the ones that chose a very narrow focus but were able to put so much energy into that 10,000 hours as a sort of a litmus test, they were able to produce superb performance. All right, first of all, that's quite essentialist anyway. You know, focus on one thing, put a lot into it. But the second finding that's far less well known is almost more interesting to me. The second item that was most correlated between the distinguishing the best performers from just merely good performers was the amount that they slept. The top performers slept on average 8.6 hours in every 24-hour period. So that included sort of, you know, normal sleep, maybe 7.5 hours, but they also then would nap routinely more often than the good performers. So what it meant was that not only were they spending more hours focused on the thing that they had chosen, it was that when they were focused, they were fully focused, they could put full energy in, they could be fully present, and so that every hour of practice was more valuable. This is just one illustration, but the idea, and we have been told it, the idea is simply false, that 1 hour less sleep equals 1 hour more productivity is an oversimplification, and it's just a false idea, and I think it does a lot of damage to people. And so, you know, one of the missions of essentialism is to help people realize sleep itself is essential. Sleep helps people to further discern which things are important and which things aren't. And when we don't sleep, we don't have that discernment.
Yeah. I'm thinking about how the essentialist decides what to give up to stop doing, you know, that's keeping us awake too late at night. I mean, how do you figure out what the priorities are? What can go so I can have a couple more hours of sleep?
Well, you have to start with a certain logic. And I know that what we want to do is get to sort of tactics of exactly how to do each of these things. But I think that first, and it's very important, first it's a mindset. Essentialism is a mindset. And this matters because until you get this mindset, all the tips and tricks and trades in the world won't actually improve this ratio. And the reason it won't improve it is because if you just learn a bunch of new efficiency tactics and how to be able to do sort of more in less time, we just stuff more into the metaphorical closet of our lives. We just try to put more in. And I'm arguing, of course, for a very different way of approaching life. So the logic of essentialism is this. It says almost everything in our life is noise, meaningless, almost everything. And a few things are exceptionally valuable and exceptionally meaningful. So we're not, using a different metaphor, we're not trying to mine for coal, right, which, you know, once you've found the coal, it's just a game of getting as much out as you can, a sort of productivity drive. What we are is mining for diamonds. It's all about this selectivity process. It's all about carefully looking and finding, okay, where is the thing that really matters most? And as soon as we have that idea deeply enough in us, suddenly a lot of behaviors start to become quite spontaneous, very natural, and sleep is one of them. I mean, the moment you believe that there are a few things that really matter, and the only way you can discover them is to have sufficient discernment and clarity of thought to be able to discover them, suddenly sleep's a no-brainer. Of course we need to sleep, because without sleep, it's almost like we're living drunk. I mean, actually, that's true in the science. I mean, you can, you know, an hour less sleep is sort of equivalent, you know, very roughly speaking, of taking another drink. And so, of course, we would know you can't discern what's essential if you're drinking all the time. But the same way is you can't discern what's essential if you're sleep deprived all the time. And so it's getting to the mindset first, I think, that helps.
Well, let's take a call from Jerry in Menasha. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, I have a little different problem, but I'm sure your guests can address it. When someone you like and respect offers to take you to an event about which they're very, very enthusiastic, at their expense, and almost insist you go when, number one, there are logistic problems. I can't sit for long periods of time. I have various problems of that sort. And it was something that I simply did not want to go to. I had a very difficult time trying to get out from under that particular offer in a polite manner. How do you decline something that you know you're not going to enjoy, that's going to be uncomfortable for you to attend, and still keep this person as a friend or an acquaintance, because I think I hurt this person's feelings by declining, and I didn't mean to do that, but I knew no way out when they literally were yeah. so overwhelmingly enthusiastic about the whole idea.
How about lying, Greg? Just kidding.
Jerry, how did you handle it?
Well, I said, no, I it was going to keep me up too late at night. I'm quite old. I'm too late at night, and I thought it was... I thanked them profusely for the offer. However, I just simply could not see myself being able to be up that late at night. And that was the only thing I could think of on the spur of the moment, because of the sleep issue was the only thing that came to mind. I was totally floored when the offer was made.
Well, it sounds like a good excuse. I need to get my sleep, Greg.
Well, you know... Let me just, first of all, frame it slightly differently. What we often think is I can either say no and offend somebody or say yes and be completely fine. And when we frame it like that, of course, we will tend to say yes because it's best to have no problem than it is to say no and have a problem. And that's exactly the kind of thing that non-essentialism has done to us. But actually, of course, there's a trade-off to saying yes. If we say yes, when deep down we don't want to, and it's late at night, and it's just not the thing we want to do, and the health reasons, and all these reasons, then if we say yes, we will immediately resent it. We will be frustrated with that person. The relationship itself still took a hit, just not the same hit. And so what I'm trying to do is help people to go, what are the real trade-offs here? You know, it's not between a yes with no problems and a no with problems. So that's the first thing, and I want to draw that out in the story, what you just said, Jerry. Now, the second thing is, in terms of being able to say no well and effortlessly, there were people I interviewed for the book, and it quite surprised me, actually, that they practiced saying no. I mean, that sounded to me like, you know, sort of the sort of quirkiest thing in the world to do, and I didn't think about it going into writing this, but literally there were people that said, I have written out how to say no in my own words and practiced it. That at least gives us a hint of where we are. We just are novices at no, we've never done it. We don't do it, or we hardly ever do it. So when the moment comes, then of course we're awkward. And so the idea is to practice so much, not that we can get it right in practice, but that we can not get it wrong. So when the moment comes, we've actually got the words and how to approach it. In the book, there's a whole section on elimination of non-essentials, but there's a whole chapter about the graceful no. And I think there's 8 or 9 separate ways that I describe in there. But overall, the idea is that the people who are best at saying no have a whole repertoire for doing it, and that they are practiced and that they're thoughtful so that when the moment comes, they don't feel panicked in the way that Jerry seemed to be feeling in that moment. They're comfortable with it. They're ready to do it. So they're okay that there's a trade-off in the relationship because they know there will be either way. But they're practiced to know the kinds of things to say.
Jerry, thank you for the call. Here's an email from Greg in Milwaukee. It seems that people just want it all. New shoes, new houses, the best of everything. We have this sense of needing things that are trivial and materialistic. I think we should break that habit, but some do not know how to do this. How do we break this habit?
Well, let me just take back to this metaphor of the closet. I think everybody's been there. Whether people are incredibly materialistic or not, we all tend to have a closet that's full, and we often think if I had a bigger closet, that would solve the problem. But as soon as there is a bigger closet, it gets full again. So it's at least something we can really relate to. When we go to give something away, when we are in that act, something happens, and we don't normally have a name for it, but there is a scientific name for what happens, and it's called the endowment effect. Uh-huh. And the endowment effect basically means that we value things more because we own them. Now, that's a good thing in many situations because, you know, we want people to, you know, care about their house and look after it and value it, or their car and look after it and value it. And we know that when people don't own things, they value them less. So, you know, we don't tend to wash our own rental car. We don't own it, so we don't value it as much. So there's a positive side to the endowment effect. But when it comes to elimination of things in our closet, coming back to that, in the very act of thinking to give it away, as we take it off the hanger, we go to give it away, we become reminded, have a heightened awareness of the fact that we own this thing. And so in that moment, we value it irrationally. We value it more than it's really worth. So the solution to that, to the endowment effect, is to trick our minds into sort of believing we don't own it. So we ask a different question. We ask, as we look at that item, we say, if I didn't already own this item, how much would I now pay for it? How hard would I work to obtain the item? And suddenly we're putting ourselves into the frame of, I don't own it. What, you know, mm-hmm. what is it really worth? And it's worth a lot less in that analysis, and so that we're able to eliminate it. Now, again, we're not really talking about things. It's the other commitments in our life, but the same thing holds true. Just because we're invited to a meeting, just because we're invited to attend a keynote at the noon hour, isn't sufficient reason for doing it. We have to ask, well, if someone hadn't provided this opportunity, how hard would I work to obtain it? And in that moment, we start to evaluate things a bit more closely to their real value.
You know, I wanted to maybe very briefly go through the Essentialist Manifesto, and just to give listeners an idea of what this is all about. Number one on this list, exercises the power of choice. Can you kind of give us a bullet point on what that means?
Well, non-essentialism teaches us we have to, just have to. And as soon as you think you have to, for example, as soon as you believe, just as the caller just was mentioning, as soon as you believe that non-essentials are non-negotiable, then you lose enormous amounts of power at that instant. And so the power of choice, believing in the power of choice, is just to remember it. You know, our ability to choose cannot be given away, or taken away, but it can be forgotten. Mm-hmm. So to remember that we always, really, truly always have a choice is the beginning, I think, of empowerment.
And the Essentialist distinguishes the vital few from the trivial many.
We talked about this briefly already, but the entire quality movement, Juran was one of the first that started it, took it to Japan, totally transformed industry there from low quality goods to quality goods in the 20th century. And he did it based on this simple idea that you've got to, but by focusing on the vital few factors, you can transform the output of any engineering process. And in a similar way in our lives, we can engineer a life of essentials by focusing on the vital few and being willing to ignore or to eliminate or to pare down the trivial many.
And instead of thinking I can do both, asks, what is the trade-off I want to make?
If I was writing a non-essentialist manifesto, top of that list would be pretend there are no trade-offs and just don't admit that there are any. But in the end, life is made up of trade-offs. We don't get to live in a world that doesn't have trade-offs. So the question is am I making those trade-offs deliberately and knowingly, or am I letting circumstances and other people make those trade-offs for me?
Here's my favorite. Knows play is essential to spark creativity and innovation. So I can be an essentialist and I can still have fun.
Well, it's not even just still have fun, although you're absolutely right. It's that this is essential in and of itself. I mean, just think about how a non-essentialist has, you know, argue for play is just, play is silly, it's pointless. In fact, a non-essentialist will argue that play is non-essential, which shows, again, the backwards thinking. What we need is space to think, space to explore, space to play, make connections. We see it in children right now. You can see this phenomenon all the time. There's the children, play is the work of children, and yet in schools, which often have been affected by the logic of non-essentialism, are consumed with it in many cases, are doing more and more what we would say is work, traditional work, preparing for test scores, memorizing more, and so on, and less play. And there's a piece of research that suggests that an increasing number of schools are eliminating, the 50 minutes play, the breaks, recess, either reducing it or eliminating it altogether. Why would you do that? You would do it if you believed that was trivial, if you believed that that wasn't the real work. But if you believe that that is the real work, that's where you discover who you are, how things work, then suddenly you would increase the amount of time for that. It's true for adults, too.
We've talked about number 5 on the Essentialist Manifesto already, making sleep a priority. And we've talked about saying no more often. Number 6 on the list says yes to only the top 10% of opportunities. I guess we can actually put a percentage on it.
Well, this is just a litmus test, a rule of thumb, but call it the 90% rule. And the idea is that we're trying to make decisions. A typical way of making decisions that is recommended in decision science is to say, well, here are all the decisions the options, and I can evaluate each option on a scale of 1 to 10. This is a 10 out of 10. I definitely want to do it. If it's a 1 out of 10, I definitely don't want to do it, and so on. If something's a 1 or if it's a 10, it's pretty obvious what to do. But if something is a 6 or a 7 or even an 8, suddenly it's not at all obvious. People get stuck in there. Absolutely. It's something that has some good to it, but there's some parts of it we don't really feel are a good fit. And the idea of the 90% rule is that if anything is evaluated in our mind as a 6, 7, or 8, that we can just immediately shift it to a 1, that we don't get muddied in the middle. Now, again, that's a fairly extreme way of making decisions, but at least it helps us to think clearly through it and to say, okay, unless something is a 9 or a 10, I'm not going to do it. David Sivers wrote a fantastic piece about this same logic, and it's called no more yes. It's either hell yeah or no.
I like that. I do. I like that very much. The next one was that we should learn how to make one decision that can eliminate 1,000 later decisions. Teach me how to do that.
It's really about being strategic, about figuring out the priority in a strategic sense. So, let me just do a little history lesson here on the word priority. So the word priority came into the English language in the 1400s, and it was in the 1500s, excuse me, and it was singular. And what does it mean? At the time, it meant the first thing, the prior thing, and it stayed singular for the next 500 years. So it was only in the 1900s that we pluralized the term and started speaking of priorities. But what does that word even mean? Can you really have many, many very first prior things? I would argue no. And so the word itself implies what's gone wrong in our thinking, that somehow just by emphasizing everything that we'll be able to fit it all in, that we'll be able to do it just because we say they're all important. And it's not true. And so you know, this idea of making one decision that makes a thousand is saying, look, what is the priority? What's the one thing that I want to accomplish, let's say, over the next, you know, the next 18 months? What's the one thing I'm actually really valuing and really caring about? And the moment we really decide on that, suddenly a whole bunch of other decisions become clear, because in the moment of trade-off, we can say, well, does that help us get to what the thing is we're really trying to do, the priority, or does it take us away? And suddenly it makes a lot of other decisions easier to pursue.
We're talking with Greg McKeown. He is author of Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. And we'll get to more of your calls in just a moment at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about how we can do less, but do it better. Our guest who says we cannot do it all, that we should pare down life to the essentials. We are talking to Greg McKeown, who is author of Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. And our next caller is Jill in Janesville. Hello, Jill.
Hi. I love this topic. Thank you for having your guest on. I am a terrible person to say no, I don't do it gracefully, but I was given advice a long time ago that you can defer or delay your answer, and that was kind of a miracle piece of advice for me. So now what I do is I find my most fatigued or tired time of day, and that's when I make the decision about commitments, and I've found that it's really cleaned up the non-essential commitments that I've made.
Because when you're tired and fatigued, you're going to say no more often, Jill?
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't figured out how to say no gracefully, but I have said no quite a bit more because I'm approaching it from, if I'm at my most fatigued point of the day, that's my baseline of energy.
What do you think of that, Greg?
Well, I think this falls under the category of experimentation with essentialism. It's trying something out and saying, well, maybe this is a way to free me from the normal assumption, which is I just simply have to say yes to everyone and everything. I mean, it reminds me at least, this isn't a direct hit on what you're saying, but it reminds me of just the reality of decision fatigue. Which is that we have, on any given day, the research behind discipline suggests that on any given day we have a certain amount of discipline, and there's not much we can do about it in a given day to increase that or decrease it. So the only question is where do we invest it? Every time we make a decision, we are using up some of that discipline. And so in a world where we're being asked to make far more decisions than we were even 10 years ago, it means that we can get quicker and quicker to this point in the day where we're just like, well, I'm out of the discipline with which to really thoughtfully make decisions. And in fact, in a famous study about decision fatigue, it showed that if you want to, if you're tried, with a judge, you want to be with that judge in the morning, not in the afternoon. You will have a more lenient sentence in the morning, a more thoughtful, nuanced decision in the morning. In the afternoon, it will just become blunter and more bombastic. And so, we think about justice being blind, but even the justices can't get away from these realities of decision fatigue. And so I think there is something to be said, for this idea of trying to, that we will get blunter in those decision making as the day moves forward. I can see where Jill's coming from on that.
I would be a little bit concerned that I might say no to a hell yeah opportunity if I was too tired.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised that this is the strategy. There is a downside to doing it when you're tired, which is that the discernment is down. But if it's in this case, I mean, I'm just going based on this experience here, if it's helping to just have the sort of almost almost blunted courage to be able to go, no, I just can't do it all, and admitting that reality. There may be some upside in that.
Yeah, is there, I mean, we have so many great ideas for authors and topics and talk shows that we can do every day that sometimes, you know, it's, let's do that. Like this program, we really were excited about doing this program. What if, how do you choose between several hell yes on the scale?
Well, I mean, I think that, again, there's no easy formula for this. I mean, the being more selective, I think, is still a key part of this. I mean, if you have two really equal hell yeah decisions, I mean, that's the right problem to have. Typically, what we have is a ton of good decisions, and, you know, and occasionally a superb full yes. And it's trying to discern between those two that's the challenge. I mean, think about Warren Buffett this way. So Warren Buffett, early on in his career, realized he couldn't possibly be right thousands and thousands of times with investments. And so he had this very simple logical idea, which is that I'm going to say no to everything unless it's an absolutely right fit. And so his basic approach to investing is to read all day long, and his company read all day long proposals for investments, all day long. This is their thing. And they just simply say no, 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 again and again, endlessly, until eventually there is something that is so right and so clearly a yes that they go all in and they hold for a long time. And so it is that you can trace back 90% of his success to just 10 investment decisions. And so this is the idea. I think it's to explore broadly, but be so selective that we only, you know, it's the quick no and the slow yes, so that we can make sure that in the end we're doing those things that we are completely sure about. We go, this is the right thing for the right reasons at the right time.
Thanks, Jill, for the call. Becky in Berlin is with us now. Hi, Becky.
Hi. My question is about raising children. I struggle with pushing them into things and wanting the outcome of good grades and activity in order to say, yeah, look at how great I am as a mom. Look at how great they're doing because they're doing all these things. And my first child, you know, wasn't everything, got straight A's, but my other two aren't in that little cookie cutter of achievement, and I have a son who does not value school, but really values sports, and, you know, I fall into the trap of, oh, well, he's just not achieving at school because he's lazy, and then I see him play golf, and he spends hours and hours and hours playing golf, and is very serious and is very committed, and, you know, I struggle with how do you help them do things that they have to do, like school, but then, you know, finding that passion, which he has in sports, because he can't play sports if he doesn't do well in school.
Yeah, can you, I'm sorry to jump in, Becky, but can we, Greg McKeown, apply the principles of essentialism to parenting and or our kids?
Now we're getting really close to an issue of my heart. I mean, I have four children, so I'm living exactly what you're describing. And again, let's just back up for a moment that schools themselves are clearly affected and infected with non-essentialism. Clearly. I mean, they came into existence in the Industrial Revolution. The whole logic behind them is a kind of efficiency model of get people through a whole set of things. You know, we're rewarding sort of the average. Everybody has to be at least good, average or good at all of these different subjects. There's no real path. There's some lip service to it, but no real path. If someone has an incredible passion for a particular subject, we don't do anything with that. We just try and keep them from being too frustrated while we get everyone else up to a certain level. I mean, nothing about traditional school is based in this idea of helping an individual to find their highest point of contribution in the world and optimizing around that. You can't do it in the schooling system. So we've got a problem there. But also parents too, as we have become sort of addicted to busyness and more and this whole, you know, busyness bubble, we're not just addicted, we're pushers too. And so that we are pulling our children into this thing and that thing and all these different extra curricular activities and more and more. I mean, the principle here is the place to start again, back to the mindset. The principle is which model do you sign up for with a child? Do you say a child is like painting an oil painting, where what we need is a layer more than another layer of more knowledge and more experience and more, and eventually they are a masterpiece? That's one model. Another model is more like the chipping the masterpiece out of the marble, where what we have to do is eliminate all the things slowly over time that aren't the right thing so that they can come forward, the very best and highest type of them that they can be. I am a strong advocate for the second. I believe that there truly is genius inside of every child and that they come more fully formed than we allow for in a traditional educational path. What our job is to help them to become more of who they are and less of who they aren't. And that requires a definite kind of discipline now, a discipline to be able to say yes when other people are saying no and no when other people are saying yes. It can be very tough in the traditional educational system because of how deep the non-essentialism logic goes. But I think it's a noble and powerful role to be a mother or a father who helps to protect our children from having to be everything, trying to measure up on all marks, and instead encourage them and help them to pursue the things that they are absolutely built to do.
Thank you so much, Becky, for the call. Well, we're running short on time. We may not get to every item on the Essentialist Manifesto, but I did want to touch on, and these two sound a little bit similar, that the Essentialist subtracts more to bring forth more and knows that if you have limits, you will become limitless. Explain briefly.
Well, the whole idea of limits, what we're talking about is boundaries. And there's really two kinds of boundaries. One is a kind of protective boundary where we don't simply say yes because somebody asks us to or puts pressure on us to do it. But the other kind is where we protect other people, that we don't simply assert our will on everyone regardless of the consequences to them, so that we self-manage that side of it. You know, there are some people that say, well, I've got no problem saying no. I say no to people all the time. And some of those people are the biggest challenges in our lives. You know, they just have no boundaries with us either. They'll say no to what they don't want, and they'll just assert themselves on us. Boundaries work both ways. And so the idea is when we put those boundaries in place, it actually makes for best relationships. It makes for better decisions. And there's a whole chapter exploring the power of boundaries. We tend to think of them as something we don't want, but really they are the key to great relationships and to breakthrough results.
Yeah. And finally, skipping forward, the Essentialist finds joy in the journey. Tell us how.
Well, I mean, this is just my experience for a start. I have found that the more I have pursued this disciplined approach to living, where you're selective and careful about what you do, what you go big on, the more I go into it, the more joyful I find it. It's not one of these ideas that, you know, get into for a while, for a few weeks, and then, okay, back to the old, because the old is better than the new. For me, it's not like that at all. If you take this writ large, I mean, there are people in history who have experimented so deeply and so fully with essentialism that they have become some of the most important leaders in the world. I mean, Gandhi is clearly one of them. I mean, he was experimenting with essentialism for decades, and it's key to how he did what he did. He called the process, by the way, reducing himself to zero. Yeah. And so in that pursuit, I mean, he stopped reading newspapers for 3 years. He spent one day a week for a period of time not speaking, only listening. He eliminated the things he owned down to 10 items. By the time he died with just 10 items to his name. I mean, all of this, a very deliberate pursuit of less but better.
I'm ready to start pursuing less. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you ever so much.
Greg McKeown is author of Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Justin Williams for producing this program. This is the Ideas Network.